Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Conservationist Harvey Locke will provide the keynote address at the 2015 Reimagine Western Landscape Symposium Saturday night. He joins me now on the road on his way to Utah. Good morning, Harvey.
Good morning.
So begin, if you will, by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a Canadian. I was born in Calgary, Alberta, and I now live in Banff National Park, which quite a few folks from this part of the world have been up to. And I work on something called the Yellowstone Yukon Conservation Initiative, which is a large landscape effort to link up the parks from Yellowstone on through Banff and to the north. And I also work on a global thing called Nature Needs Half, which is the idea we should protect half the world in an interconnected way.
All right, we'll talk a little bit about more of those in details, but what was it that got you into conservation?
Well, as a kid, my parents are actually from Banff itself, and as a kid, I spent a lot of time in the mountains drinking water from streams and hiking, and I just thought that was normal. And when I went to go to college in Switzerland in the beautiful Alps, I was appalled to see how degraded the Alps were. The wildlife had disappeared, most of the streams were dammed, there were a lot of cow manure in whatever streams were still running, and it just devastated me to see a beautiful landscape with no nature in it. So at 16 years old, I kind of made a vow to myself that I would not let that happen to my home, and here I am almost 40 years later still working on that idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, going to school to learn some of the principles then behind the science and everything, or...?
Actually, not at all. I was there to learn French, and I also wanted to ski. And so it was a very unexpected side effect. And then I ended up going to university and did an undergraduate degree in the humanities. And actually, that's who brought me here, is the faculty of the Environment Humanities Program at University of Utah is combining with Reimagine for me to be here for a few days. So I'll be lecturing at University of Utah before I come up Park City. And I also did a law degree and practiced law for a while. Actually 14 years, and then I got very involved as a volunteer conservationist and found that was more meaningful, so I ended up resigning from my law practice in 1998 and have been working full-time on nature conservation since then.
Wow. So as you mentioned, you have founded the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative. Can you tell us more what that is?
Yeah. We've learned that national parks are the most effective means that we have ever found as humans to conserve nature. They work really, really well. However, we've also learned that a national park as an island in a landscape full of other developments that isolate it completely from an ecological context won't make it through time. They can become islands of extinction. So we need to not only protect and create national parks and wilderness areas, we need to connect them to each other across the landscape so that there's viable populations of species and we avoid inbreeding problems or catastrophic events that wipe out populations. No way for animals to get back into the system. So that's the origin of the Yellowstone Yukon idea. And the essence of it is that Yellowstone Park would get connected up to Glacier Park and the Canadian Park Waterton, which abuts Glacier. And we want to expand that park into the Flathead Valley of British Columbia. Then we want to see that connected up to Banff National Park and Jasper National Park, and then that connected up into northern BC, and then that connected up into the Yukon and Northwest Territories. So it's this very large interconnected system that will ensure that the natural values we cherish in those systems are with us forever.
How successful has that been?
Well, I'm pretty pleased. We've been at it 20 years, and there's been a lot of key parcels of private land that have been bought from willing sellers to secure linkages in the landscape, you know, along the edges of roads and things so animals can get across. There's highway crossing structures that have been built over highways in several locations in the Yellowstone-Yukon region to allow the animals to go over the road. They're directed to these crossing structures through fences as opposed to being run over. And then we've also been able to create, in the Northwest Territories of Canada, a very large new national park in the Nahanni watershed, which is one of the largest national parks in the world now, up in the north. And we've been able to also see some additional protections for various values, like, for example, caribou in southern British Columbia. So we're doing well. We haven't yet achieved everything we hope to. Yellowstone is still, in terms of grizzly bears, an island, and we need to see it reconnect across through Idaho and up into southern Canada. But I feel good about it. It's actually become the global example of large landscape conservation. People all over the world are familiar with it.
Yeah. So are you working with a land conservancy to do this, or is your initiative in and of itself a land conservancy?
No, we work with about 180 partners, so we're more of a catalyst than we are an organization that's focused on itself, although we do some things ourselves. So we work with seven different land trusts, and we work in cooperation with the Nature Conservancy, with an organization called the Battleground Foundation that actually got its start here in Utah. We work with the Canadian Nature Conservancy, which is a different organization, the Land Trust of British Columbia, the Trust for Public Land here in the States. We work with a broad cross-section of groups, and the point of intersection is where there's a priority in the landscape that helps keep the whole thing connected and together. We work with whatever land trust is interested in that particular area. But we also work with public lands groups that are interested in ensuring that all animals remain in the system and so on. So it's a wide-ranging teamwork. It's really all about the vision. Where do we want to go? How does everybody line up their efforts together to get this in a positive place where we can ensure a positive future for nature in this world full of too much bad news?
Yeah. Nature needs half is a message you also share with audiences around the world. So what do you mean by that?
Well, when you look at the scientific studies that are done all over planet Earth that ask this question, what would it take to keep nature intact in all its expressions in a given landscape or a given ecosystem? And they ask questions about, well, how do you represent each natural system, all the native species, how do they move around the landscape, how are they resilient in the face of things like flooding and fire and climate change? All those studies come in the range of half or more. The idea that we should protect and interconnect. So it's not just protecting, but it's also that connecting a network up of protected areas. They're all coming in the range of half. So a few years ago, few of us decided we just need to start saying that out loud, and the phrase we came up to say it with is nature needs half, and it's the idea that we should protect at least half of the world in an interconnected way and recognize that humans are one species among many in this landscape, and we need to be more generous and share the world in a way that keeps it intact, because it will actually benefit us too in the long run, as well as be the right thing to do.
Well, I wanted to ask you more about that. The title of Saturday's lecture is On Behalf of Wild Nature, and certainly we know that wildlife needs natural areas of land and water, but why do humans? I mean, and would somebody living in New York City even believe that?
Well, New York City is a really good example of how people need nature. They get their water from the upstream in the Hudson River watershed, and they found that they were going to have to spend $750 million to build a water treatment plant because things were being fouled upstream. And instead, they spent that money buying up a variety of farms and other forest areas to protect the watershed so the water would be naturally clean. And they actually spent less money doing that than if they had built a treatment plant. And one of the things that we need to understand better as humans is we evolved in this world with other species and with intact natural systems. That's where we get our water from. That's how our climate is regulated. That's how we have the right levels of acidity in the oceans and everything else. And right now, that's out of balance. We've become so clever that we've learned how to manipulate those things in our favor. And we're creating problems for ourselves. So many of the estuaries of the world's oceans are dying or dead, meaning no life in them, because there's too much nitrogen upstream in the watersheds washing in from farms and things like that where we haven't been careful enough with our use of fertilizer. Similarly, we've all along the world's oceans, we've been destroying mangroves, which are the best beach protection from erosion. And we need to stop doing that. And with climate change, most people aren't conscious that the conversion of natural systems, intact natural systems, is causing 20% of the annual emissions to the atmosphere every year, which is more than all the cars in the world put together. So if we stop beating up nature and started protecting it better, we would actually do a great thing for the climate. But we just need to start thinking about it differently than we have been. And I'm not very much into casting blame or being angry, but I'm into taking action and being forward-looking.
Yeah. So how do we make that happen? I mean, is it really just about setting aside more, say, national monuments? Because here in Utah, where more than 50% of the land is federal land, I mean, the state is prepared to spend millions of dollars defending its right to take over ownership of those properties. So it's having that open space hasn't gone well over here in the state of Utah. Or perhaps we've a great example of protecting our open lands because of the federal ownership.
Well, I'd invite Utahns to think about it this way. Utah has a lot of public land, and it's done well in protecting some of them. And those have been not only very important to the quality of life of Utahns, but very important to the state's reputation and to its economy. I've spent a lot of time in Utah visiting your national parks, which are exceptional by any standard. And, you know, the idea of a state defending its right to take back public land is a very curious one, because the public land, of course, is the federal public land domain is just a different constitutional level. So that's just a debate about who has control. It's not really a moral position. And the real key issue is, how do we live well in the landscape, keep the entire system intact, and have humans thrive too? And the answer is not that we overwhelm natural systems. The answer is we have to strike a balance between our needs and nature's needs if we want to have healthy lives as humans, and also beautiful lives where we get to see birds in our backyards and get to watch clear skies in the morning, things like that. For me, I see humans as one species on the earth among many. We're a very smart, very powerful species, and we also need to be a humble species.
As we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act last year, you wrote that wilderness alone will not be sufficient to save nature in all of its glorious expressions. So what else needs to be protected?
Well, private lands that people choose to protect, either with organizations like the Nature Conservancy or Trust for Public Land or Vital Ground, we need those because they tend to be concentrated in valley bottoms where most life is concentrated. We know that river bottoms are extremely important for the health of the entire landscape, and they're almost always in private hands. So we need private actions also to contribute to this idea of keeping the world intact. We need state parks can be very effective. State wildlife refuges can be effective. Municipal parks can and have been very effective at protecting nature when they're managed with that in mind. And it's the aggregate of those things. So if you take Boulder County, Colorado, just over the other side of the mountains where I lived for a while, over half of Boulder County is protected through a mix of national park, federal wilderness, roadless area, private land conservation, City of Boulder Conservation, and Boulder County Conservation. And Boulder's considered one of the nicest places to live in the United States and is also one of the most prosperous. So we can do that. And certainly along the Wasatch here, you've got some beautiful landscapes protected, and you could do more.
Well, as I mentioned, Harvey Locke will be in Park City Saturday night providing the keynote address at the 2015 Reimagined Western Landscapes Symposium, taking place at the Swanner Eco Center. Tickets are available by going onto their website. Harvey, look forward to meeting you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Well, thanks so much for being interested. I look forward to being in Park City.
Drive safe. It's 8:27 now. Good morning. Well, a man is in custody after leading police on a high-speed chase last night. He was captured by a police dog in Salt Lake City. The action started just before 6 o'clock here in Summit County when deputies responded to reports of a man getting in and out of vehicles at a grocery store near Kimball Junction. When police arrived, they say the suspect fled in a stolen vehicle. An eyewitness reports several, maybe 10, black SUVs screaming down the canyon. Officers did back off for safety reasons. They found the suspect with the help of a helicopter. He had to then be treated for bite wounds. Well, crews are on site at the PC Mark getting ready to install solar panels on the city-owned recreation building. In the studio with details, I have Matt Abbott. He's Park City's sustainability manager, along with John Conde with Alpenglow Solar. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Matt, the Mark had to get first a new roof, but we're ready to go?
Yeah, nearly ready to go. The roof we had installed didn't meet specs, so we pulled our warranty and we replaced the whole roof. It's a much more sound roof. Good spot for solar.
Okay. So When do we start?
We're staging right now, getting all set up, and we're looking at starting pending weather next week. So we're kind of getting things moving along now.
All right. So can you tell us what's going to be installed, John?
So we're going to be installing a total of 755 panels that are made in the U.S. They're actually going to be supplied by Jay Miles, who is a local here, supplying it from Russell Pacific. And we'll have 550 of them viewable from the parking lot, so on the sloped roof over the tennis courts. And then 200 of them will be over the basketball court, and that won't be really visible to anyone at that point. So,
all right. So when we did the remodel of the Mark, that was kind of the thinking. We knew it faced south. So get over.
Yeah. I mean, the thinking was actually a different roof, but we might put some solar hot water heaters on that roof. There's a little flat roof near the studios. But yeah, as we started speccing out the possibilities for a solar installation, we saw we had a lot more room and a lot more possibility.
All right, so how much energy does 755 panels create?
It's going to be producing nearly 20% of what the Mark is consuming annually, and that is roughly 300,000 kilowatt hours annually.
So 20% of the 300?
Create 300,000 kilowatt, and that's 20% of the consumption that. Total consumption of the Mark.
The Mark is an energy hog. It's our number one electricity user, number one natural gas user.
Besides the pumping stations, the water department, huh?
Well, the water department as a whole uses more electricity, but they have no one facility that outperforms the Mark.
Okay. So is this the biggest system to be installed in Park City?
Yeah, this triples our total portfolio. It's twice as big as the rest of what we own.
Wow. And the cost?
It's $425,000 is, I think, about where we penciled this in. We got a great price from Alpenglow.
Yeah. And did you receive any kind of grants or?
No, this is the first project we've paid for out of pocket. Our previous six projects were partially grant funded or wholly grant funded. We're like 90% grant funded for our portfolio. So this is our first big leap into our own production.
All right. You gave them a great deal because you're selling 755 panels, huh?
Correct. Yeah. And we're local and we really wanted to be involved with a local project like this.
All right. So, you know, Matt, we also often hear, you know, return on investments. I mean, what is that for Park City Municipal then?
This one's a 21-year payback. When we link it into the whole portfolio, we'll be paid off by 2020. And there's a lot of projects we have as a city that don't have an ROI. So even though this is a longer ROI, it's totally justifiable.
Hmm. Why does it take so long?
So as a city, we don't trigger the same tax rebates that a private, like a home or a business would. Since we're an untaxed entity, we can't trigger those 40% tax rebates.
All right. So what changed the council's mind? Because, as you know, it took a couple of asks, you know, to get council approval to go forward with this.
I think we've had a lot of success with our previous projects, and I think that's really important to build up from a small project into a large project. I know that the school district is looking at a very large project. And it's a lot to bite off when you jump from spending $0 on solar to, you know, $425,000 on solar.
Yeah. So, John, do we have any other large installations like this in Wasatch or Summit County?
This is the largest that I'm aware of. I know that Summit County just awarded a fairly large one, about half the size, maybe a little bit bigger than half the size for the Justice Center. And then there's one that's less than half the size on the health center. So there's some pretty good sized systems in Summit County.
Yeah. And because you're just one of maybe a handful of solar companies in Park City, Matt, do you have any idea? I mean, how much solar's been installed over the last 5 years or so?
I know that when we looked at Summit Community Solar, and this is before these big projects went in, we're at about a megawatt countywide. So I think probably by the end of this year, we're getting close to 2 megawatts.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive then. So we've seen in the past two community bulk buys. Last year's, I think, was through the University of Utah. The first one was through Community Solar. Do we have plans to do another one of those?
Yeah. So Mary Krista Smith met with Utah Clean Energy, and Utah Clean Energy ran both U Community Solar and Summit Community Solar. And so we're figuring out when we can do another community bulk purchase. And we're also looking at how we can engage the commercial market with commercial PACE coming online soon.
All right. So, and you're also involved, I know, with Summit Community Power Works, as I am. I mean, probably this will be a big step in the idea to win the $5 million, because part of the competition, of course, is reducing power use.
Absolutely. It's a huge dent on the city's bill. And it shows that it's a feasible project to do and that we have local talent like Alpenglow that can get things like this done. So I think it's a great step forward. And it's there's a lot of evidence that solar projects create more solar projects. People see it and they want to do it. So a big, prominent, aesthetically pleasing project in Park Meadows seems like a great place to.
Yeah, and it's actually definitely the case. Rocky Mountain Power is actually feeling that, and they just had a forum for all of us solar installers stating that we potentially have issues because of that congregation of solar. And so the transformers that exist, if we get to a certain point, may not be able to handle more. And so that we definitely see that concentration of solar happening.
Explain that. That doesn't make sense to me.
Rocky Mountain Power has limits on how much. I don't know the specifics to it, but they have limits on how much solar can be backfed into the system. And it has to do with the minimum base loads that they have for that transformer or system where you are actually putting the solar into. And once you get to a certain capacity, they are saying other things have to be done or no. So,
yeah, Park City is hitting Rocky Mountain Power's capacity for solar.
Yep.
So we could very well see, I mean, because they had last year had asked for some kind of fee, just saying that it's what they need to build the system. And certainly solar owners kind of fought back and won it, at least at that round. But it sounds like they may have a case for something.
There's an ongoing docket this year that the city's engaged in, and there's a lot of other entities engaged in to try and get Rocky Mountain Power up to where they need to be on these issues, understanding both the costs and the benefits. They have a history of externalizing the environment, and solar does the opposite. So we're trying to meet in the middle somewhere and figure out what the right price is, how much solar we can have up here, and not have our utility telling us whether or not we can put solar on our roofs.
So in terms of the system itself, it costs 21 years to pay it back, is it going to last that long?
It is. The system actually has a 25-year warranty on the production warranty on the panels. The solar panels have no moving parts, and we fully expect them to be 25-plus years. There are solar panels still producing electricity after 40 years being on a roof. So.
Yeah, but at full output? Or
they do diminish over time, and that's one thing we take into account, and that's what the warranties are for, that they have a minimum amount of production output after that 25 years.
All right. So what kind of improvements have we seen in solar cells panels over the last few years?
The biggest thing is efficiency in production has brought down the cost of the solar panels themselves. One of the things that we're seeing the biggest change is the inverters themselves that take the DC electricity and change it to AC that we can use in the buildings. The inverter costs have come down quite dramatically, and they continue to do so. A few years ago, a very large inverter would be used for the mark, for instance, and now we can do it with several small ones, which is a big, big change in the industry, and it makes for a little easier installation, lower cost on the equipment. So those are the kinds of changes that we're really seeing as installers.
Yeah. So this is snow country. Are panels, are they durable in the winter, even though you couldn't argue that with this year? But
yeah, this year was a rough year for the snow. They are very durable. They are made and designed to be outside. We even have a video of one of our manufacturers. They were driving over one with a truck, and it didn't break. They're designed for this. They're designed for having heavy snow loads on them, large hail impact. It takes a lot to break these, and it's pretty amazing, even though they are they're glass. So They're definitely designed to be outside and in the weather.
Yeah, I saw this on a right-wing web page, it was some kind of joke, but it showed solar panels, basically blaming solar panels for creating some of the climate change problems we have just due to the reflectivity of the panels. Is that really an issue?
I haven't heard that one. I do get questions about reflectivity all the time. And if you think about what a solar panel is trying to do, it kind of will start to eliminate that argument. The companies, the solar panel companies, spend a tremendous amount of money trying to actually implement anti-glare, because they don't want any of that solar energy being reflected away, because they're trying to capture it to increase the efficiency. So the glare of a solar panel, there's been studies put out that bare earth has more glare than a solar panel. So it's the reflectivity is really minimal.
Okay. So again, you hope to start next week, but we've heard certainly some reports of snow that might push installation back. You don't need a slick roof.
Correct. Yeah. We'll definitely be, if we have any snow, we'll put us a little bit of a delay on that.
So. Yeah. And then that it takes how long to actually do?
We're looking at probably, depending on weather and whatnot, we'll probably be finished up within a month once we start, and should take less time than that.
All right. And is it going to create any issues for those who frequent the Mark, Matt?
It shouldn't. Alpenglow is working really closely with Ken Fisher at the Mark and Tate Shaw, and they're coordinated, figuring out like what the tennis schedules are. And there's not a lot of time spent inside the facility. It's mostly on the roof and outside, and no giant screws going in. So, yeah, no noise.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we're taking up a few parking spaces around on the east side just for where we're setting up for our staging, and we'll have some of the roadways closed off while we're actually daylight hours during our construction time. But it should be fairly minimally impacted. So.
All right. Anything else, you guys?
No. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you.
Matt Abbott and John Conde, thanks for your time. KPCW News Time now. KPCW News Time now, 8:41. Good morning. Well, Utah officials say some residents may need to verify their identities with the State Tax Commission before receiving their tax refunds this year. The Utah State Tax Commission says it has seen a spike in the number of attempts this year to steal identities of taxpayers and fraudulently collect tax refunds. Spokesman Charlie Roberts says Utah residents are receiving letters and questionnaires from the Tax Commission asking them to verify their identity. He says some residents have questioned if the documents are a scam, but he says they're needed in order to receive a refund. He says anyone concerned may contact the Tax Commission office at 801-297-2200. KPCW News Time now, 8:41. And in the studio with me from the Summit County Health Department, I have spokeswoman Katie Mullally along with Allison Stewart. She is the health educator. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So we're talking this morning about active transportation. It's something, Allison, that you've been working on?
Yeah, you know, the health department has been a fan of active transportation for a long time because of the health benefits that come with it. And now that the community is so interested in some of the traffic concerns and alleviating that, it's become a bigger part of the conversation. And we're eager to be a part of that and talk about being more active with our transportation choices while it's on the community's mind.
So what's the health department doing about it?
One of the things we're doing is trying to get the word out more. You know, we started off by adding a section to the website with a lot of resources that people can go to.
Yeah, we wanted to, you know, with public health, because we aren't typically the lead agency, but we're really good about bringing together other bits of information and other groups together to share what everyone else is doing. And so we started a new webpage on our health department site, on active transportation. And on it, we have a great map from Basin Rec and Mountain Trails of paved trails. You know, we see so many of the trails, but that deals with mountain bike trails and hiking trails. And this is a really comprehensive paved trail map that you could actually use to navigate your commute from the store to home to work to and back. And then also great information on ways to tune your bike and when you need a new pair of running shoes, and links to the city's bus system. We wanted it to become a really good clearinghouse for information for people, because so they only have to go to one spot. And again, as Allison was saying, it really helps promote one of our missions, which is, you know, creating a healthier community.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the health benefits. I mean, we've got, of course, if you're out of the car, you're getting some exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's the obvious ones of if you're out of the car, you're walking more, you're biking more. But even people who are taking public transit are getting those extra steps during the day, getting to and from the bus stop. So people who are not driving have a lot of opportunities to get that physical activity during the day. But there's also benefits that go beyond that. For instance, if we're not in our cars as much, our air quality is going to be better. And I know a lot of people like to live up here because the air quality is good, and we want to keep it that way. So looking at kind of that environmental health. We can even go as far as talking about financial health, where if we're not in our cars as much, we're not spending as much money on gas or on car maintenance. So there's a ripple effect that can occur if people are looking at ways to use, you know, active transportation modes instead of just relying on cars.
All right. So you've got the map. Do you have also like the transit schedule?
There's a link to the Park City Municipal Transit schedule, their page, their apps, their map, their timers. Yeah. So there are links in there. If you go to the page at summitcountyhealth.org, there is a new menu for active transportation, and you can go in there, and again, you can find information on the city buses, the county buses, well, the city and county buses, trails, equipment, bikes, shoes. And one of the things that we really liked about the idea of active transportation, using that term instead of, you know, ride your bike more, walk more, is transportation is something that we can all relate to, and it's something that we all utilize throughout our day. And so to think of incorporating activity and movement into your transportation hopefully will be an easier way for people to incorporate it into their daily lives, instead of thinking of getting on your bike as something separate and an activity that you do after you've driven home. You can incorporate the two of those.
So is there any way to like measure how good of a job you've done with this?
That's a great question. You know, we haven't started building those things in, but I think some of the ways we can measure is if we see more people out on the trails and hear the stories of people talking about their commutes, people posting pictures or talking about it, you know, seeing maybe even reductions in traffic. So some of the things that will help us know if it's success will be coming from the stories that we hear from others who are also working on this issue.
I know that the county right now is doing a campaign, a Twitter campaign and a Facebook campaign, where they're trying. They're promoting all the county employees who once a week take an alternative mode of transportation, whether that's biking. We were able to do that last week because we had one sunny day, and then carpooling. And so on the county's Facebook page, I think it's Summit County Facebook page, I don't know what it's called. Anyway, they will post images, photos of all of the staff doing an alternative mode of transportation, which has been really great to get people to think just once a week, something different. You know, again, whether it's carpooling, walking, biking.
All right. Well, you know how competitive Park City is. Any plans for some kind of competition?
Not that I've heard.
That's an interesting idea, though.
Yeah, it could be really fun, especially with not just Park City, but maybe the school districts. And, you know, I think we'll have to look into that.
Okay. Well, again, all of the information is on the website, summitcounty.health, and then just search for active transportation.
Summitcountyhealth.org. I think there's a couple of ways to get into that. I think it's on the scrolling page, and then also there's some menus on the side and on the top that can get you to that.
Okay. And I notice you also have a link up here, Active Transportation. This has been put out by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Can you summarize that for us?
It's an agency that's interested in the health aspects of using active transportation. So they've done some studies and reports that help discuss the benefits and give some credibility to why we want to promote this from a public health standpoint.
Okay. Anything else?
Just a reminder to restaurants that the dog variants permits are up and available, and we will be enforcing the pooches on patios. And so it's a lot more cost effective to apply and get the permit than it will be to be busted and fined and possibly closed down if you're doing it too much.
Yeah, I had somebody call and you know, kind of complain in the sense that it was just, they thought that the $300 fee was just a little bit too much. I mean, it was something I think that was brought up with decided upon by the Restaurant Association, no?
I don't know the history of the fees structure. I do know that with this dog variance permit, it requires extra work on the environmental health staff because they have to go and, first of all, approve the permit, and it's a routine follow-up with these establishments. And so it's not like it's an effort-free endeavor from our side. There are staff time and costs involved in doing this. And if the original proposals for the fee were significantly higher. And then as we talked to the Restaurant Association and the Board of Health, the cost was significantly reduced. But if you think about it from a marketing perspective, if you're a restaurant that can legally have pooches on your patios, that's going to be a huge boost in your business. And so the $300 that you spend on getting the permit, you could probably make up on a nice sunny summer day.
Okay. Hey, Katie and Allison, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:49. KPCW News Time now, 8:50. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. With Vail Resorts now on board to help protect the dilapidated historic mine structures on ski resort property, local residents will begin raising an estimated $5 million that it's going to take to get the work done. In the studio, I have former Park City Council member and Summit County Commissioner Sally Elliott. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Leslie. That's pretty good news, isn't it?
Yeah. So Vail Resorts has offered to put up $50,000 this year to help pay for what? I mean, are we talking about
just
a map?
Emergency stabilization. And the whole effort is centered not on adaptive reuse of those old mining structures, because they're pretty far gone, but just their maintenance in a stable way so that they can remain the pictorial artifacts that we keep in our minds that we like to see when we ski around.
All right. So do we have an inventory of the structures?
You know, we have a partial inventory. Sandra Morrison at the museum, of course, has been working on this for a long, long time. And she and I have joined in a sort of ad hoc effort to get this done. There's no formal committee. There's no formal structure. You know, ad hoc is that noise you feel in your throat when you say yes to yet another project. Okay. Anyway, it's not a formal organization. Perhaps it will become that consortium of people who are interested in the stabilization of the structures.
So without an inventory, I mean, how do we know? I mean, there's
well,
this $5 million.
And we've done, you know, we've got the county inventory. We have the city inventory. And Vail Associates has agreed that even though the municipal requirement with Park City to stabilize the structures and do some inventorying was a requirement of the Empire Canyon Group, they're going to take it on because they're the best able to do it. They're the people on the ground, and they're the people with the big equipment and the know-how to do it. So Sandra went up earlier last year before the snow flew and did a little bit of just emergency wires between things to keep timbers from falling down. And she incurred a debt of about $50,000 for that structural maintenance. And Bill has agreed that he will complete the inventory with Vail Associates and wipe that requirement off the books. So we will have an inventory. We will have an engineering assessment of what needs to be done. And the cost of $5 million comes from the earlier assessment that Sandra did. So, you know, we've been working around this as just volunteers in an informal way for a long time.
So do you and the group have a priority list then of what needs to be done first?
I think we need to see the completed list first. I think probably the California Comstock Mill building is the most threatened.
And that's just located there near the base of Thanes
In Thanes Chairlift. Canyon, mm-hmm. Right at the bottom of Keystone and Hoist Runs, yes. This is just so encouraging to me because you know that I've been working on this for 29 years. When I first started as a ski instructor in 1986 at Park City Mountain Resort, nobody could tell me the stories of the buildings, and that's how I got started doing research and writing. And then when Robbie Beck was public relations, PR, marketing at Park City, she hired me to do a little brochure that was on glossy paper of all the pictures of all the buildings and a story about each one and a little self-guided tour. So when Bill's appointment was announced, I shipped that off to him with a letter about the structures. So, you know, I've been trying to kind of guide him and nurture him, and boy, is this encouraging. This is the first time we've ever had official institutional support for anything like this. It's really good news to me.
Yeah. So what have we lost?
Well, we've lost a lot of the interior structure of the California Comstock Mill. And I think they moved the old, the turning wheel that ground the ore up. They moved that up, I think, to the old mine tour museum. I'm not sure where it is. Anyway, we've lost a lot of pieces of these things. The Thanes shaft is... the elevator's in pretty good shape, but the boarding house fell down, and it's just lying there on the ground in pieces. and the conveyor belt that goes from the shaft out to the big mine dump is falling down, and it's a little frightening to me because pieces are falling off of it, and there are people up there trying to get that powder shot all the time, and I'm afraid a piece of it will fall down.
So does, like, the boarding house get rebuilt, or does it just get left?
I have no idea. Hmm. We'll just have to wait and see about that. You know, it's a little bit daunting to consider raising $5 million. That's a lot of money to raise, but the Vail Associates has promised us access to their facilities, and it'll be fun.
So fundraisers sounds like at least for the next 5 years.
It'll be a while.
Yeah. Okay. And so I guess things get fixed as you have the money to do them.
I think that's probably the case.
All right. You've also been involved in raising money to get editions of the park record online. Right now we have microfiche, I think, going back to day one, yeah?
We do. We have in the entire thing. Sandra can always talk me into anything like this, but she was able to get work with the federal government and the State Library Association to digitize the first 100 years of the park record from 1880 to 1980. And in about a year, maybe a little over a year, a group that I put together of people who have an interest in this has been able to raise enough money to digitize from 1980 to 1986. And those files now are online at UtahDigitalLibraries.com. So if you look up that on the internet, you'll be able to find many, many digital newspaper resources from throughout the state of Utah. Particularly the Salt Lake Herald and the Salt Lake Tribune are very forthcoming with information about Park City's history. But the Park Record is the oldest continuously published newspaper in the state. So it's a real treasure for history and information.
Yeah. So is there a charge to access that website?
No. It's free, unlimited usage, and it's, of course, free to anyone in the world who has a digital connection. So we feel very privileged to be able to do this. The cost is about $1.65 per page. And so we're trying to raise about $250,000 to complete the park record, and then to go back and do the old newspaper, which was a competitor with the park record for a number of years, from 1972 to 1982. I'm unsure of those dates, but the newspaper was an invaluable source. And the people who published that are a part of this committee, and they're helping to raise the money and give the input. So it's quite a nice group of people. We don't meet very regularly, which is what I like about ad hoc committees.
So this $250,000, that would pay for the 86 through 2015 then?
That would pay for us to digitize everything that is not currently digitized. Mm-hmm. Some of it we have paper copies of, and those are much clearer, better copies. Some of it we only have microfilm, which can be a little bit blurry because, you know, the more times you photograph something, the less clear the photograph is. But it's all a very good project, and we feel very, very happy to have put 6 years online.
So this has been private and public money then?
This has been a little bit of private money and a lot of public money. The first digitization was done with federal money, but that's pretty much dried up. So we're having to raise the money through local sources now.
All right. So when do you think you'll have that done?
Oh, sometime in this lifetime. we have a new contact at the University of Utah, and we're going to be asking her to help us get the digital content from 2004 forward online so that we can just publish that online every time a new issue comes out. And we'll keep current with it that way. I don't know whether that'll be an ongoing endowment or what it will take to do that, but we'll work on it.
Okay. Hey, good work. Saving history. Thanks, Sally.
Thanks, Leslie. Bye-bye.